You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support.
This is Diane, and we'll be reading from the Tribune. Paul's going to be joining me, and he's reading from the Sun. The Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Paul, would you like to say hello? Because I don't know what I'm saying.
Yeah, everybody's in a rush this morning. I'm sorry about that, including myself. But anyway, I hope everybody's doing well out there today.
Yeah, it's a little chilly.
It is a little chilly, but it is December.
This is true, and we need to learn to think about that instead of always wanting it to be something other than it is. All right, I'm going to start off with From Tree to Shining Tree. I like that title. Out of Methuen. The merry mantra, "It's all about the trees," was proven true as thousands packed the festival grounds to catch a glimpse of twinkling lights and bedazzled ornaments on a collection of about 200 Christmas trees with a chance to take one home. Pine-scented walkways of raffled-off evergreens returned the Branch Street's Valley Office Park for the Festival of Trees, where the two-week fundraiser wrapped up for the season on Saturday. The curtain fell on the holiday tradition's 32nd annual appearance, drawing more than 25,000 visitors eager to stroll through windy corridors lined with elaborately decorated Christmas trees, mini trees, and wreaths. Each tree, donated by local families, businesses, schools, or civic groups, came with a white raffle box and one lucky raffle ticket tucked inside a visitor's picked and those their favorites amongst the bunch. Volunteers spent their Saturday night pulling winners between 9 and 11 p.m., and by Sunday morning, recipients began streaming through the doors to claim their holiday prizes. Started in 1994, Methuen's Festival of Trees has become a beloved seasonal outing as a successful fundraiser for historic preservation projects across the Merrimack Valley. The organization has awarded more than $2 million in grants to nearly 60 preservation partners in 25 communities. Grants of up to $10,000 are offered through the Historical Preservation Grant Program. Last year, the festival awarded the Salem Historical Society a grant towards restoring windows at the 1738 Meeting House and Old Town Hall, a $375,000 effort. Past projects include the Amos Blanchard House and Andover Unitarian Universalist Congregational Church in Andover, Buttonwoods Museum, and Tattersall Farm in Haverhill, and a whole wish list worth of Methuen landmarks such as Elmwood Cemetery, the First Baptist Church, the Masonic Lodge, and the Tenney Gate House, which now houses the Methuen Historical Society and Museum. President and board member Rosemarie Redman greeted families at the entrance over the weekend, watching as children tugged parents towards glittering pine cones and snow-dusted needles. The whole thing started because of the efforts to save the Tenney House. Gatehouse, Redmond said. Then it just grew. Santa Claus himself took a sabbatical from his workshop in the North Pole to spread cheer through all 15 days of the festival. The man in red, with a long white beard, rosy cheeks, and circular lens spectacles, posed for photos with one toddler after another as families lined up to snap a photo. But Saint Nick wasn't the main attraction. That was the hundreds of creative displays showcasing Methuen's most elaborately decorated donations. Among them was the comprehensive grammar schools. The CGS is Wicked, inspired by the 2024 fantasy musical film, with its design split in vibrant halves of green and pink. The Wicked-themed conifer earned third place for best tree created by children. Second place went to Girl Scout Troop 84631 for a very beachy Christmas decorated with mermaids, flip-flops, and sand pails, a beach day in the middle of December. One contribution stood out from the rest, a Nutcracker's Noel, was an 8-foot-tall nutcracker transformed into a miniature library donated by the Pascucci family. It took third place for most unique display. Kathy Gable wandered between the rows, admiring each donation. She said she visited the Festival of Trees for years, but this season was different, as it was the first year her family had donated a tree of their own. The Chaff family built Crafty Christmas, a cheerful hand-sculptured tribute to Gabe's late father, William Bill Chaff Jr., who died in 2015. Chaff was happiest when working on model trains, woodworking projects, needlework, and photography, she added. He was very crafty. We decided to do something in his honor, Gable said. Everyone in the family had so many of his tree ornaments, and we had so many left over. So we said, let's build a tree. More than 100 volunteers helped bring this year's event together, managing the raffle as well as gift shop and a live auction, which offered items like signed photos of Drake May and Taylor Swift. Sports memorabilia, local getaways, and golf outings. By closing time on Saturday, families were taking those final seconds to deposit their last tickets into raffle boxes with hopes of taking home an early Christmas present. Over to you, Paul.
All right, so this first story is a follow-up to one I mentioned last week, which was the Sun Santa Fund event at the Polish-American Club. And there's a huge picture in the front of the family of Edward Kuzek with Santa, of course, and a couple of his helpers during their 17th annual Sun Santa Family Christmas Party. And this event was held in memory of Kuzek, a longtime resident and Vietnam War veteran who passed away in April at the age of 76. While reflecting on his father's life, John Kuzek recalled how Edward P. Kuzek, a long-time resident of Lowell, grew up in what he described as a little tiny apartment on Spring Street with his mother and two siblings. He would tell me if it wasn't for the Salvation Army, they probably wouldn't have had Christmas dinners, John said. So it stayed with him through the years and he wanted to give back. John added that his father would say, you don't always have to give back, but if you have the means, you should. And that's exactly what Edward did. And he was a longtime supporter of the Sun Santa Fund, along with his wife, Mary. He regularly pitched in to help where he could. And of course, the Sun Santa Family Christmas Party was held in honor of Mary, the year she passed away 16 years ago. Like his wife before him, Edward, a U.S. Army veteran who served in Vietnam, died in April at the age of 76, and he was honored at this event. The event was hosted by the Polish Americans Veterans Club at the Dom Polska Club on Sunday. If it wasn't for others giving, he would have gone without, so he was a big advocate to give back who were not as fortunate as him. And giving was on display at the Dom Polska Club on Sunday. And Tricia Indelicato, the organizer of the party, buzzed around the room while guests purchased raffle tickets, nibbled on pizza and other treats. The highlight, of course, dare I say it, of the annual gathering came when old Saint Nick himself arrived, delighting children and adults alike with photos and the chance to whisper their holiday wishes. And Delicata thanked the community and the many who helped make this party possible every year. It's important for me to give back, and now that I see the need with the amount of people who are struggling, it's more important, she said. The Sun Santa Family Christmas Party has raised thousands of dollars over the last few years for the Sun Santa Funds, which provides assistance to families in the 23 communities that are served by the paper. And Dave Damaris and Peter Goyette, both Sun truck drivers when they were much younger, came up with the event as a way to give back to the community. With this in mind, they chose to raise money for the Sun Santa Fund. We knew it was a good deal because all the money was going back to the children of the community, Damaris said. And that's why our slogan is, a child's smile makes it all worthwhile. Kevin Coughlin, the president of the Lowell Sun Charities, said seeing the generations come together through the event is heartening. It's a wonderful sense of community, he said, noting that it is one of the longest-standing traditions which is tied to the Sun Santa Fund. Coughlin also pointed to the reach of the Sun Santa Fund, sharing that in 2024, the program served 1,144 families in need, and that included 2,500 children getting toys, along with food vouchers and toy vouchers. The spirit of giving continues from 10 a.m. to noon on Saturday at the Littleton Police Department, here it says, where another drive-in for the drive-in and drop-off event for the Sun Santa Fund is taking place. Also on Saturday from noon to 4 p.m., Lowell Mayor Dan Rourke will host a Sun Santa Drive, quote, pints for a purpose to benefit the Sun Santa Fund and the local families at the Old Court Bar in Central Street in Lowell. Rourke's goal is to raise $10,000 to help 100 families in the greater Lowell area. Manager Tom Golden will conduct a live auction during the event at 2:30, and donations to the Sun Santa will be accepted during the event in the form of a check or cash. So, there you go. The Lowell Sun Santa thing is a really good organization.
It is a very good organization. Yeah. Unfortunately, this year, people are just in a financial predicament.
Yeah, I know.
They're doing a lot more extra things, and kudos to them for really making that happen.
That's good. So,
okay, so I have heating assistance funding available finally. The Trump administration released federal funding for the low-income home energy assistance program last week after more than a month's delay. Governor Maura Healey announced Thursday that all applications can now be processed. As we hit cold winter weather, we are relieved that funds are finally flowing now and families can apply for help heating their homes. Our team has worked to make this funding available immediately because our families cannot afford to wait, she said. According to Healey's Secretary of the Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities, Edward Augustus, home energy assistance is one of the most important tools we have to keep people safe in the winter. For many of the households we serve each year, HEAP is the difference between a warm home and an impossible choice between heat, food, and medicine, Augustus said. Now that this funding has been released, our team and our local partners are moving quickly so that seniors, families with children, and people with disabilities can get the help they need as the cold weather sets in. LIHEAP is a federal program referred to as the Massachusetts Home Energy Assistance Program, or HEAP, in Massachusetts. That typically helps more than 150,000 households in the state, representing more than 300,000 people, afford to heat their homes during the winter. This federal funding usually becomes available in early November, but it was delayed due to the federal government shutdown. Massachusetts Senator Edward Markey expressed relief that the Trump administration was finally distributing those dollars to the state. I will continue to fight for these dollars in Congress and for programs like LIHEAP to be strengthened and expanded, especially as energy costs continue to rise and families in Massachusetts and across the country stare down another cold winter. During the pause, the Healey-Driscoll administration utilized leftover federal funding from last year to support households with heating emergencies. The Department of Public Utilities also extended its shutoff moratorium to include a period from October 27th to April 1st. Apply for HEAP through your local community action agency or designated fuel assistance provider, either online via the toapply.org portal, by calling your local agency for an appointment, or by mailing or dropping off documents with options often available through MassCAP's locator or specific agency websites such as the Greater Lawrence Community Action Council, Community Teamwork, or Action for Boston Community Development. Over to you, Mr. Paul.
Okay, so I think that everybody realizes that almost every big city and probably in this country has something which people associate with it. And this story comes out of Boston, and it's to do with the Citco sign, which is near Fenway Park. And this sign, it says, will soon be moved and rebuilt. The Boston Skyline's iconic Citgo sign will be moved and reconstructed as a part of the final phase of the One Canmore Square development on Beacon Street. The sign, which has been a fixture of the city skyline for more than 60 years, is being repositioned 30 feet higher and 120 feet to the east to restore the original view shed corridor, whatever that means, ensuring that it will remain a landmark and become synonymous with, of course, the final stretch of the Boston Marathon, Red Sox games, and Kenmore Square itself. The Citgo sign has become one of the most recognizable symbols of the city, Carl Schmidt said, vice president of supply and marketing at Citgo Petroleum, at a press conference on 660 Beacon Street. Originally installed as the city's service sign in 1940 before being reinstalled in 1965 as part of the introduction of the Citgo brand, the Citgo sign has long served as a visual and cultural anchor for Canmore Square in the city of Boston. With federal and state exemption in hand, Citgo is ready to take the final step in this redevelopment process of this iconic sign, ensuring that our beloved sign will continue to illuminate Kenmore Square and the city of Boston's skyline for generations. Just turn over. The sign has become synonymous, of course, with the Boston Marathon, serving as a marker for generations of runners reaching the final mile of the race. And, of course, it's also visible behind the Green Monster at Fenway Park during Red Sox games, and has become a landmark for residents and visitors to the city. An agreement to preserve the sign was reached in 2019 between Citgo and the company, which purchased One Canmore at 660 Beacon Street and is being used as a mixed-use lab and office development for Boston University. Citgo officials explained Thursday that moving the sign will require to be taken apart piece by piece and rebuilt in its new site corridors. Not only does the sign need to be rebuilt and repositioned to accommodate this Kenmore Square development, but also to stabilize the structure, given that the steel that anchors it has been in place since the 1960s. The project will include construction of a new truss structure built into the anchor platform, which is built into the roof of 660 Beacon Street, while the sign's overall height and dimensions remain the same. The steel truss is approximately 90 feet tall to support the 60 by 60 foot Citgo sign. That's pretty big. Originally, the sign was lit by neon lights, but in 2005, they were changed to LED lights with about 218,000 lights used to illuminate the sign at night. While there's been no risk of collapse, the sign has been subject to a past fire, according to Pam Beale, president of the Canmore Square Business Association. This sign has stood as both the beacon of Canmore Square and a beloved symbol of Boston, Beale said. Moving the sign is an important milestone for this community because it's about preserving an iconic sign, and it is also a reflection of a shared commitment to the future of this neighborhood. Suffolk Construction is the project contractor, and work is expected to begin in the near future, Schmidt said after receiving City Hall approval. Today, we get to say that for future generations, this sign will be present and visible, said Boston City Councilor Sharon Durkin, who represents the neighborhood. This sign is incredibly important to the fabric of Canmore Square, and today we have no questions about its future. So it is a pretty iconic sign.
Yeah. Yeah. So, mm. Kind of like the sun.
Yeah, the sun.
There's another one.
The sun in Lowell. Right. Yeah, exactly.
All right. I've got Democrats call for Hegseth's ouster. Out of Boston, members of the state's all-Democrat congressional delegation are joining calls for Secretary of State Pete Hegseth to resign or be fired amid controversy over airstrikes on Venezuelan drug boats and his sharing of classified information through a messaging app. Hegseth faces increasing criticism over the use of military force in the Caribbean Sea after a special operations team reportedly killed survivors of a strike on an alleged drug boat off the coast of Venezuela, in what some legal experts have labeled a violation of the laws of armed conflict. Separately, a Pentagon watchdog announced last week that it determined Hegseth put U.S. military personnel and their mission at risk when he used a signal messaging app to convey sensitive information about a military strike against Yemen's Houthi militants. The swirling controversies prompted a growing number of congressional lawmakers, mostly Democrats, but some Republicans, to criticize Hegseth's actions, with rising call for the former Fox News host to step down. Senator Elizabeth Warren called Hegseth a walking national security threat and said his sharing of classified information on his cell phone is another reason he should step down or be fired immediately. Secretary Hegseth was reckless with our nation's security, jeopardizing American lives and demonstrating he's unfit to serve as Secretary of Defense, Warren said in a statement. How many more times does Secretary Hegseth have to put our military in danger before Republicans say enough is enough? U.S. Rep. Seth Moulton, a Salem Democrat and a Marine veteran who served 4 combat tours of duty in Iraq, also echoed calls for Hegseth to step aside, saying his refusal to take responsibility for his actions shows a complete lack of accountability that should be unacceptable for anyone in uniform, let alone the Secretary of Defense. Any rank-and-file member of our military who behaved this carelessly would face severe consequences, and the standard for the Secretary of Defense should be even higher, Moulton said. Secretary Hegseth came into this job as the most unserious, unqualified Secretary of Defense in the history of our nation and has lived up to that reputation with flying colors since then. He should be fired. Hegseth was confirmed as defense secretary in January after Republican Vice President J.D. Vance broke a 50-50 tie in the U.S. Senate to push through his appointment. He has been behind a series of controversial moves at the agency, including reviving its pre-World War II name, the Department of War. A Pentagon's Inspector General office released a report Thursday that concluded Hegseth jeopardized troop safety and violated department policy when he shared secret information in a signal messaging chat in March that included details of a planned airstrike in Yemen against Houthi fighters. The report was released as Hegseth faced a firestorm over his authorization of a second missile on an alleged Venezuelan drug boat it had destroyed in an initial attack, killing 2 people reportedly clinging to the overturned boat. Hegseth defended the second strike as emerging in the fog of war, telling reporters during a cabinet meeting last week at the White House that he didn't see any survivors, but also didn't stick around after watching the initial strike on the boat. Congressional leaders were shown video of the boat strike during closed-door briefings Thursday with Navy Admiral, I'm assuming, Frank Bradley, the special operations commander who oversaw the operation. Following the meeting, top Democrats blasted the incident and called for Hegseth's resignation, while Republicans who control the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate said they believed the second strike on the boat was justified. Earlier in the week, President Donald Trump defended Hegseth's tenure as defense secretary and said he thinks he's doing a, quote, great job in the top position. Of course he's going to say that. Over to you, Mr. Paul.
Yeah, can somebody define for me...
great job?
No. Fog of war.
War, yeah.
So they're at war. Who are you at war with? Oh, I don't know. But anyway, this story is a kind of a follow-up to a story I did last week, and it's in the area of education and student cell phone use. And the headline is, poll shows parents favor student cell phone crackdown, but the survey also says parents also want to be able to contact their children during the day. It comes out of Boston. Two-thirds now support the proposed bell-to-bell cell phone ban in public schools. But a significant number say they want a clear way to contact their children during the school day, according to a new poll. In a survey released Wednesday by Mass Inc. Polling Group on behalf of the Education Trust, 66% of parents with children in grades 6 through 12 said they support legislation that would prohibit students from having personal electronic devices, including cell phones, in their possession for the entire school day. That support includes 40% who said they strongly support the measure. Meanwhile, 63% of those parents said they want to know how they could contact their child during the school day under such a ban. And 49% said they would want a detailed explanation of the policy, including any exceptions. The poll surveyed 1,351 K-12 parents, including 890 parents with children in grades 6 through 12. Given that 88% of those older students reportedly have a cell phone or a smartwatch, the issue appears relevant to most families. Support for the ban was fairly consistent across racial groups, though the highest was amongst white parents, 41%, and Asian, American, and Pacific Islander parents, 48%, expressing strong support. Fathers, parents over the age of 45, fathers were at 46%, and parents over the age of 45, 47%. Those with a college degree or higher, 46%, and households earning more than $75,000 annually were at 45,000. Mass Inc. also conducted a focus group in September with parents of middle and high school students. Participants expressed broad support for limiting distractions in the classroom, while also raising concerns about safety and communication in emergency situations. Many parents noted that their children rely on phones for transportation, coordination, mental health support, or in rare instances of bullying. Elizabeth Neely, whose daughter attends a Boston public school, echoed those mixed feelings in an interview with the news service. Neely said she understood the rationale for a ban, but worries about safety. I could see why they're doing it, but today with what's going on in other states with violence and schools and stuff, they need their phones. That's not safe, she said. There was an incident at my daughter's school in January, and we got a text from them hours after it happened. Neely said her daughter keeps her phone on her during school, but refrains from using it in the class. But she says that some students, especially those with social emotional anxiety, benefit from the ability to check in with parents during free periods throughout the day. The poll and parental feedback come as the legislature is considering a statewide ban. In July, the Senate overwhelmingly approved a bell-to-bell ban that would require all public school districts to restrict personal electronic devices during the school day starting in 26-27. Supporters say that the measure would reduce distractions, improve academic performance, foster mental health, reduce cyberbullying, and encourage social interaction in the class. The legislation includes exceptions for students with medical needs or individualized education plans and requires schools to provide a method for parents to contact those children during the day. The bill awaits action in the House of Representatives, where leadership had hesitated to take a stance until recently. House Budget Chairman Aaron Milovich indicated last month that the chamber is considering taking up the Senate's measure. And even with strong support among parents and legislators, the new poll highlights that many families want clear guidance on how to communicate with children during school hours. Oh, yes.
Okay. So I actually have a Dear Joan that I think is really important at this time of year. The title of it is Surviving Our Feelings During the Holiday. And a lot of times people can get very depressed. So it's important that we read this. My mom is in her 80s and has always loved the holidays. This year, she says she's just not in the mood to celebrate. Should I be concerned about this? How should I handle it? The holiday season can be a time of joy and celebration, but it also can bring up feelings of sadness and stress. The loss of loved ones, physical limitations, and other changes can make feeling festive a challenge. These feelings of sadness, loneliness, or depression are often called the holiday blues. Here are some ways you can help the older adult in your life who might be facing the holiday blues. It's not only older people, because I'm in my 60s and I'm going through it. Check in regularly. Make time to connect with your loved ones on a regular basis and be mindful of any changes in mood. Include them in holiday traditions. Whether it's decorating, cooking, or attending religious services, including your loved one can help them feel valued and connected. Offer help. Holiday to-do lists can be stressful. You can help by assisting with shopping, decorating, or rides to holiday events. Encourage self-care. Remind your loved one to get enough rest, eat healthy meals, exercise regularly, and spend time doing things they enjoy. Be patient. Have compassion and try not to judge. The holiday season can be emotionally challenging for us all. Sometimes we just need someone to listen. While occasional sadness is normal, persistent or severe symptoms could be signs of something more. Watch for signs that professional guidance may be needed, such as change in appetite, sleeping too much or too little, avoiding friends, family, or social situations, extreme mood changes. If you notice any of these things or just have a feeling something's not right, make an appointment for your mom to see her doctor. Remember, simply being present, listening, and showing compassion can make a meaningful difference. While the holidays can be challenging, small gestures of connection and support can help your loved one feel seen and valued. I wish you and your family warmth, comfort, and moments of joy this season. Are you caring for an older adult or need help finding healthy aging resources? Our experienced staff is available to help. Visit agespan.org or call 800-892-0890. Over to you, Paul.
Very good, good lessons there.
Yes, very much so.
This is a local news. It actually comes out of Nashua, but it's a follow-up to that previous story I told. And this is Joan Stylianis, who says on the headline, "School cell phone ban, a smart move." See what she thinks about this. "I have no horse in this race, but I still applaud New Hampshire Governor Kelly Ayotte signing into law a statewide bell-to-bell policy prohibiting cell phone use from the beginning of the school day through dismissal." So New Hampshire has moved on this issue. "I'm also one of the few dorks who are..." No, that's me. I'm like that, too.
Yeah, I'm a geek and a half.
"I'm also one of those few dorks who own a smartphone and still have a landline." Well, I gave up mine last year, but whatever. "The latest figures show that only 24% of U.S. adults have a landline. But if there's a massive mobile network outage, a landline can usually work. And these vintage phones can also help connect with home security systems and medical alert sensors for immediate assistance during an emergency. I imagine it hasn't been easy for Granite State students to give up their phones during the school day, especially since they've grown up in a world saturated with technology. It's not their fault. Their lifestyle includes using phones and social media, but many educators and parents believe that these personal digital devices are big-time distractions in the classroom. And some think that cell phones cause students to struggle with concentration and learning, to develop social media stress and comparison, or to join in cyberbullying during school hours. Behavioral experts believe excessive cell phone usage can often lead to what she describes as student loneliness and a decline in face-to-face communication. Governor Ayotte doesn't regret signing Senate Bill 206 into law last June, which was passed overwhelmingly by the legislative body. "We want every student in our state to reach their full potential in and out of the classroom, and cell phones were getting in the way," she said. "I was proud to sign a bell-to-bell cell phone ban into law given districts the flexibility to adopt what works best for them while ensuring teachers don't have to be the phone police. Question, how did we manage without these digital devices in the past? It's a good question. I remember spraining an ankle during gym class as a high school freshman, and I hopped over to the school nurse's office, and she called my mom, who came to pick me up. In the event of an emergency, most students would head to the main office to use the phone. We even had the occasional bomb threats back then.
I remember that.
Unwanted individuals entering the building, and school officials dealt with those things. It wasn't a perfect system, but it worked, and we all managed to get by. It's a different world today, and a recent article in The Atlantic magazine by Rose Horowitz discusses an alarming trend discovered at America's top universities. I couldn't believe it. Apparently, the word disabled has come to mean something new in higher education. More than 20% of undergrads at Harvard and Brown University, which are Ivy League, are registered as disabled, and 34%, one in three students at Amherst College, are said to be disabled. However, it's not about the original meaning of the 1990 landmark civil rights law known as the ADA or the Americans with Disabilities Act. One professor without tenure at a selective university who wished to remain anonymous told The Atlantic that you hear students with disabilities, and it's not kids in wheelchairs. It's just not that. It's rich kids getting extra time on tests. The ADA law was amended in 2008 to broaden the definition of disability. The umbrella amendment now includes conditions such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety and depression, which can impact focus, reading, concentration, and learning. And she asks the question, is this kind of student accommodation an exploitation of the true meaning of the Americans with Disabilities Act?
No.
Or am I just behind the times?
I think she's just behind in the times. Mm. More and more people have that. Yeah. I got diagnosed at 56. Yeah. So, I mean, you can't judge a person for their ability to learn or not learn. That's horrifying. Mm. All right. On that note, we're moving on to something more pleasant. There's a whole article about for the holidays. There's a bazillion things going on. So I'm going to read them because you never know who's going to want to do what. So it's the article's called For the Holidays. And the first portion says Andover Garden Club presents Decked Out for the Holidays. Jana Milbacher, principal of Enchanted Gardens, will present Decked Out for the Holidays at 10 a.m. December 9th at the Andover Garden Club meeting at South Church, 41 Central Street. The public is encouraged to take advantage of this program. A $10 donation is requested of non-members. The public should mention if they are a member of another garden club. This virtual tour of decorated mansions and illuminated gardens in the Northeast includes the world-famous Longwood Gardens, Winterthur, Blythewald, Newport Mansions, and other beautiful landmarks. Milbacher is a lecturer and author. She combines horticulture, design, and travel tips to educate, inspire, and delight new and seasoned gardeners. Her latest book, Gardens of the Gilded Age, Lavish Landscapes from America's Golden Era, to be published June of 2026, takes readers on a virtual tour of some of the most breathtaking historical gardens in America. Contact Garden Club co-chairs Mary Ann Marshall or Barbara Riker. Mary Ann can be reached at 508-265-5487 and Barbara at 978-996-0203 for information on joining. Next up, out of Plasto, Pancake Breakfast with Santa. Head to the Carl G. Davis American Legion Hall for a Pancake Breakfast with Santa from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. on December 14th. Tickets are $7 for adults, $3 for children ages 4 to 11, and children under the age of three eat free. That's hard to say. Hampstead Christmas Parade. The town is hosting its Christmas parade at 1 p.m. on December 14th. The parade theme this year is Gingerbread Christmas. Timber Lane Performing Arts Center Tuba Concert out of Plasto. The TCMA Concert Band and Jazz Band will host a Tuba Christmas concert and band performance at 2 p.m. on December 20th in the auditorium of the school, 40 Greenough Road. The event is free. For additional information, visit tcmamusic.org. The Rotary Club of Andover launches Holiday Lights Contest. The Rotary Club of Andover has announced its inaugural Holiday Lights Contest, a festive fundraiser designed to brighten the town and bring neighbors together in the spirit of giving and celebration. The contest is open to residents, neighborhoods, and businesses throughout Andover. It invites participants to showcase their most dazzling holiday light display while supporting the Rotary's charitable initiatives. This concert is more than just lights. It's about illuminating the generosity and spirit of Andover. Event Chair Jamie Lyman said, "We're excited to see homes and businesses shine while raising funds for causes that matter. Registration is open and will close on December 9th at midnight, so hurry up, that's tomorrow. There are multiple categories to participate in and include best house, best neighborhood, best business, and best professionally installed display. The entry fee is $20 and all the proceeds benefit the Rotary Club of Andover's Charitable Trust, which awards grants to local, regional, and international nonprofit causes. Judging will take place on December 10th. Winners will be announced on December 15th. Those who enter should make sure their display are lit on the judging night." All right. Lastly, local dancers to perform the Nutcracker. Six local dance students of the Andover School of Ballet, Jazz, Tap, and More of 14 Park Street are gearing up to perform in local area productions of the holiday ballet, The Nutcracker. These students rehearse their roles every week, as well as continuing their schedule of weekly dance classes at the dance studio. The Andover School of Ballet, Jazz, Tap, and More has been in town for more than 45 years. Each dancer went through an audition and then waited to hear if they were chosen for a role in order to be cast in these productions. These dancers will now have the opportunity to perform on stage in a professional production and learn firsthand about the life of a professional dancer. Performing in the Dance Prism production of The Nutcracker on December 20th to December 21st at the Collins Center for the Arts at Andover High School, 100 Shawsheen Road, are Scarlett Price, Sally Minier Rosado, Elena Scott, Julianne Yates, Janavi Kumar, and Olivia Knight. Some students perform in touring cast dancing every weekend from November 30th to December 21st in Fall River, Sudbury, Littleton, Worcester, and Andover, while other students in a regional cast will perform their parts only in the Andover performances. Kumar and Knight are part of the touring cast. Okay, now, the Spirit of Christmas Past at Kimball Library out of Atkinson. The Friends of Kimball Library will sponsor the Spirit of Christmas Past, Four Centuries of Christmas in America at 6 p.m. tonight, Monday, December 8th at the library on 5 Academy Avenue. This well-illustrated lecture traces the development of the celebration of Christmas from when it was outlawed in the 17th century New England through the mid-21st century when all the trappings of a traditional Christmas were in place. For many, the celebration of Christmas today is the most important holiday of the year. However, many of the customs, which we take for granted as part of current holiday festivities, are actually a product of more recent history. The presentation will look at how Christmas transformed from a rowdy celebration to a family-centered event. Among the topics discussed are how Christmas trees were raised, halls were decorated, and Santa Claus came to town. To register, go to www.kimballlibrary.com or call 603-362-5234. Out of North Andover, Christmas at Rolling Ridge coming up. Rolling Ridge Retreat and Conference Center is planning Christmas at Rolling Ridge from 2 to 7 p.m. on Sunday, December 14th, and 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, December 17th. Guests will be invited to stroll through decorated rooms at their own pace, then cast votes for their favorites. This is the first ever holiday decorating showcase at the venue, which involves staff with their family and friends adopting rooms in the Georgian manner with the intention of transforming the spaces into a festive wonderland. Bedrooms, meeting spaces, and the grounds will be adored in holiday splendor, and you will have the opportunity to select the winners through your votes. This is a family-friendly event. Adults are $15 per person. Children ages 5 to 12 are $5, and children under 4 are free. Hot cider, hot chocolate, and other beverages, along with freshly baked Christmas treats, are available as part of admission. For more information, call 978-682-8815, extension 009. Over to you, Paul.
Okay, so this is slightly unusual, but I noticed here in the Lausanne that there was was called an obituary of note. And I was looking at this man, and he's really a giant in the history of music for the last 50 years.
Oh,
so
wow.
I feel like I want to read this. He's really interesting. Puerto Rico salsa giant Rafael Ithier, who led El Gran Combo for more than a half century, has just died. He was the founder of the legendary salsa band El Gran Combo de Puerto Rico, whose hits have inspired Bad Bunny and other icons from the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico. And he was 99 years old.
Wow, God bless.
The cause of death wasn't immediately clear, but the family said that Puerto Rico has lost a giant, a man whose life was dedicated to elevating our identity through the art and rhythm that distinguishes us in the world, says Marlies Cifre, the mayor of Ponce. He was not only the founder and musical director of one of our cultural pillars, but he was also an example of discipline, excellence, and a deep love of our land. He was a self-taught pianist, arranger, composer, music producer, and orchestra conductor of what many consider was the best salsa orchestra in the world. He was born in San Juan and raised in the working-class community of Rio Piedras, and he lost his father at 8 years old. But he embraced music, picking up the guitar at 10 years old, and he played at the corner store for tips, according to the National Foundation for Popular Culture in Puerto Rico. By 14... he left school for economic reasons and found a job where he could. A year later, he joined his first group, Conjunto Al Hawaiani, and learned to play the Cuban tres and the double bass. He later learned to play the piano and taught himself how to read sheet music. In his mid-20s, he joined the U.S. Army and was stationed in Korea. But he later traveled to New York and formed the Borinquer Mambo Kings, named after the 65th Infantry Regiment of Puerto Rico, a renowned all-Hispanic and segregated army unit that received medals for its service in World Wars I and II and the Korean War. He eventually moved back to Puerto Rico, although he nearly gave up his musical career after the band he was in, their singer, was arrested. He planned to study law, but was convinced otherwise by two Cuban brothers who founded the El Gran Combo. And on the group's opening night of May of 1962 at the Rock and Roll Club in Bayamón, he took to the piano, and the rest is history, as they say. He led the El Gran Combo for more than a half century with his trademark smile and black mustache. And he confessed in a paper interview in 2016, at 90 years old, that he was shy about celebrations. He attributed the orchestra's success to not luck, but to the discipline he learned while in the army. I learned to be a man and to obey an order. That discipline is what I apply to my life and what I base my life on, he was quoted as saying. Under him, the band attracted many musicians and was nicknamed the University of Salsa. He taught us and demanded responsibility, discipline, professionalism in our work, and if you wanted to belong to the group, you had to meet those standards. The orchestra played on 5 continents, released 40 albums, and had a mass of hits everywhere. So all salsa fans everywhere were mourning the news of his death. So,
wow.
I must admit, I'm not familiar with him. Familiar with him. But, I'm a white guy. I'm from Ireland, you know.
I bet if I asked my sister-in-law, she'd know. She grew up in Ponce.
Oh, okay. Oh, there you go. There you go.
I think we're going to take a break right now, and then we'll be back shortly, and we'll carry on with whatever is newsworthy. Thank you for listening thus far. You're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB would like to thank you, Mass Lowell's WUML-FM, for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. That went much better than the intro. All right, article, deadly crashes involving older drivers on the rise. To mark National Older Driver Safety Awareness Week from December 1st through December 5th, AAA Northeast is spotlighting the rising number of fatal traffic crashes involving older drivers across the United States. Between 2014 and 2023, the population of people 65 and older in the United States increased by 28%. During the same time, the number of older drivers involved in fatal crashes increased by 41%, while the number of older licensed drivers increased by 38%. In 2023, the last year of available federal data, 7,891 individuals aged 65 and older were killed in crashes. Even more concerning, individuals aged 80 to 84 showed the highest fatality rate per 100,000 individuals. In Massachusetts, there were over 420 fatal crashes involving an older driver, 65 plus, from 2020 to 2024, according to the Massachusetts Impact Crash Data Portal, accounting for 22% of all fatal crashes during that time period, 1,897. The rise in fatal crashes involving older drivers reflects the growing number of licensed drivers aged 65 or older nationwide. In 2023, there were around 52.9 million licensed older drivers, an increase of 16 million from 10 years ago, according to the latest available data from the Federal Highway Administration. There were approximately 1 million licensed older drivers in Massachusetts in 2023, an increase of 260,000 from 10 years ago. AAA research shows that while seniors are less likely than their young counterparts to engage in risky behaviors while driving, they are a greater risk of being killed or seriously injured if a crash occurs. It's critical to balance the need for seniors to be active in their communities with safety behind the wheel, said Mark Shield Drop, spokesperson for AAA Northeast. Family and caregivers can help seniors stay safe on the road by encouraging them to keep their driving skills sharp and having an open and honest conversation if changes are needed. AAA offers the following tips for senior drivers and their families. Review new technologies. Today's new vehicles are often equipped with a variety of safety features, from lane-keeping assistance to adaptive cruise control. Review your car's manual or watch video tutorials to ensure you're comfortable with how these systems work. Monitor your health. Various medical conditions, eyesight problems, or memory issues can make driving more challenging, and some medications can impair driving ability. Talk with your doctor and pharmacist about your safety on the road, given your unique medical history. Adjust your driving habits when necessary. Some seniors may only drive during the day, avoid highways, or make 3 right turns instead of an unprotected left turn. Families should discuss the best strategies to keep an older driver safe behind the wheel. Wear your seatbelt. Wearing a seatbelt is the best protection you can give yourself in the event of a crash. Over to you, Paul.
Okay, so this isn't quite as uplifting as the last story about that Puerto Rican gentleman, but it's more of today's reality, and it comes out of New Orleans. And, excuse me, there's been a crackdown, an immigration crackdown there. It says state and federal authorities are closely tracking online criticism and demonstrations against the immigration crackdown in New Orleans, monitoring message boards around the clock for threats to agents while compiling regular updates on public, quote-unquote, sentiment about this issue. The intelligence comes even as officials have released few details about the first arrest made last week as part of what's called Catahoula Crunch, prompting calls for greater transparency from local officials who say they've been kept in the dark about this operation. Online opinions still remain mixed, of course, with some supporting it, these operations, while others are against it. Early bulletins noted a combination of groups urging the public to record ICE and Border Patrol, as well as additional locations where agents can find immigrants. The authorities have insisted these sweeps are targeted at the usual suspects, quote, criminal illegal aliens, but law enforcement records detail criminal histories for less than one-third of the 38 people arrested in the first 2 days. Local leaders told the AP that those numbers, which law enforcement officials were admonished not to distribute to the media, undermined the stated aim of the roundup. They also expressed concern that the online surveillance could chill free speech as authorities threatened to charge anyone interfering with this enforcement. It confirms what we already knew, that this was not about public safety. It's about stoking chaos and fear and terrorizing communities, said State Senator Royce Duplessis, a Democrat who represents New Orleans. It's furthering a sick narrative of stereotypes that immigrants are violent. The Department of Homeland Security did not respond, of course, to questions about this. And the next thing says that the DHS, Homeland Security, has publicly detailed only 6 arrests stemming from this operation. And these were people with criminal histories, including a man they vaguely said was convicted of homicide and one of sexual assault. The agency on the ground in Louisiana has said it aims to make at least 5,000 arrests in the region over the next couple of months. Americans should be able to live without fear of violent criminal illegal aliens harming them, their families, or their neighbors, Tricia McLaughlin says. And it's been framed as, once again, as targeting violent offenders. But records show that only 9 of the 38 people arrested, as I've said before, had a violent criminal history. New Orleans City Council President J.P. Morrell said the stated goals of the operation to arrest so-called violent offenders did not align with the reality of what's taken place. There's literally no information being given to the city of New Orleans whatsoever. If the goal was for them to come and augment existing law enforcement to pursue these violent criminals, why wouldn't you be more transparent, he said. The crackdown appears to be a dragnet focused on people with brown skin, citing viral videos of encounters such as masked agents chasing a 23-year-old U.S. citizen returning home from the grocery store. Law enforcement officials have been carefully tracking this footage and public reaction. For some supporters, the videos with sounds of children crying in the background as their parents are under arrest is weighing heavy on their hearts. The records also shed new light on cooperation among state and federal authorities, which was welcomed by the governor of Louisiana. The FBI and Customs and Border Protection of agents at the Louisiana State Analytical and Fusion Exchange, which is an intelligence and data gathering center. On one briefing noted that some have, quote, gone so far as to accuse agents of racially profiling Hispanic areas specifically. And another post on social media suggests that their agents are not keeping with the mission of targeting criminal immigrants only. The chatter is slower during the night on these posts, mainly just commenting on posts from earlier of the day. But once daylight arrives and agencies are back out, the chatter and posts pick up. These briefings have been identified as being no threats to law enforcement, but the Fusion Center has sought to debunk what it calls false reports that a pedestrian was fatally struck by law enforcement. It's been confirmed that this actually did not occur. One other briefing described an incident involving, suspicious persons at an ICE facility in St. Charles Parish. And some local officials that had been unaware of the state's role on this online monitoring of social media chatter said that the Louisiana State Police pledged, quote, operational support to immigration authorities and warned the public that the troopers will arrest anyone who assaults a federal agent or causes criminal damage. This Fusion Center has also tracked tools used by protesters to foil federal immigration enforcement, highlighting links to whistle handouts, training on filming federal agents, and the emergence of a hotline for reporting arrests. The surveillance extended to activist discussions about immigration authorities' presence near an elementary school and recapped demonstrations inside the New Orleans City Council chambers and elsewhere. Rachel Tabor, who is an organizer with the grassroots advocacy group Union Migranti, says, they can monitor me all they want, she says. And she says that her authority through this group, they will share crowdsourced reports and videos of the federal immigration enforcement operations. We are not doing anything illegal. And Beth Davis, who was also a spokesman for this group and has organized trainings, said, it's sad that authorities seem preoccupied with law-abiding citizens. Another immigration story there.
Yeah, I've learned to not say a word. I should just keep my thoughts in my head.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have an article actually out of the Chicago Tribune. Costco puts Trump's tariffs on trial at the kitchen table. Costco has become a symbol of American abundance. It's a place where you can buy a 10-pound rack of ribs, Christmas lights, a new winter coat, shoes for your kids, a flat-screen TV, or those delicious gluten-free macaroons. You can get a massive slice of pizza for $1.99. If you're a hungry high schooler, you can buy the whole pie for $10. A handful of viral videos on TikTok and X show people from communist countries such as Cuba, as well as former Soviet bloc nations, having emotional reactions as they first experienced the store's aisles of plenty, wandering awestruck amid cases of oversized meats, prepared food, and clothing. To some degree, most of us feel that sense of wonder when we walk into one of these warehouses. The point is, Costco is a beloved part of American culture, a place where you can get a good deal and a good meal, and about 1,000 other things. President Donald Trump's tariffs are on their naughty list this holiday season. Costco is suing the Trump administration, asking the courts to overturn the sweeping tariffs imposed beginning in February under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, and arguing the law doesn't actually give the president authority to levy import duties without the approval of Congress. The retailer is also seeking refunds of tariffs that has already paid this year on imported goods. Costco has not publicly disclosed the cost it has incurred due to Trump's trade wars, but it's certain to be a lot of money. And when one of America's biggest retailers is forced to shoulder substantial new tariff costs, a fair chunk of those expenses show up in its price tags. Ordinary Americans ultimately pay that freight. Americans trust Costco with a kind of bipartisan affection that's increasingly rare in today's politically fraught consumer landscape. The chain symbolizes value, fairness, stability, and competence, traits many voters feel or our politics lack. When a brand with that sort of credibility publicly challenges a president's signature economic policy, it punctures Trump's narrative that his tariffs primarily hit foreign governments rather than American consumers and businesses. In short, Costco has loads of clout with suburban families, small business owners, and other middle-income shoppers who watch prices closely. What they say and do matters. The mega retailer isn't the only company that's challenged Trump's tariffs. Learning Resources LLC, a Vernon Hills toy maker, also filed suit, as did Revlon and Kawasaki Motors. The Supreme Court recently heard arguments on the challenge by Learning Resources and another plaintiff, and is expected to decide within the next few months. If the court rules against Trump, it would deal a major blow to what has become a central plank of the president's trade agenda. No matter what the courts decide, shoppers are already feeling the consequences. Even with inflation cooling, prices remain well above pre-pandemic levels, giving warehouse clubs a bigger role in helping families stretch their budgets. And if the brand on which you rely for necessities points the finger at tariffs, you're more likely to listen. Trump can shrug off criticism from economists or Democrats, but when one of the country's most beloved brands says his trade policy is misguided, it risks shifting the conversation from ideology to everyday life, where Trump's message is most vulnerable. Over to you, Paul.
Okay, so a lot of political stuff in the papers these days, unfortunately. Sorry for everybody. But on the other side of the equation here, this is a story about the Democrats and forthcoming elections. And it says that Democratic governors say the party's midterm strategy must focus on pocketbook concerns. Democratic governors met this weekend in Arizona, looking to parlay last month's big victories for the party in New Jersey and Virginia into campaigns for next year's midterms, when a majority of governor seats will be up for election. Those elections help Democrats zero in on what they see as a strategy to help grow their ranks in office and recover from big losses in 2024, when voters put Donald Trump in the White House and give Republicans majorities in both houses of Congress. The plan is to focus intently on making life more affordable, a message they hope will work even in some conservative-leaning states. We have to be laser-focused on people's everyday concerns and how hard life is right now for the American people, said Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, the new chairman of the Democratic Governors Association, and a possible candidate for president in 2028. Everybody wants the economy of tomorrow, but paying the bills today is absolutely critical. He and other governors said Democrats can use the affordability message as a cudgel against Trump without making him the central focus of their campaigns. Yes, we can judge a president, and we should judge this president, Beshear said, but we never judge those voters. The meeting of Democratic governors comes as blue states have been under fire from the Trump administration, which is exercising power in novel ways against the president's perceived enemies. Trump has deployed the National Guard in California, Oregon, and Illinois over the objections of the Democratic governors, and his administration has demanded detailed voter data and threatened to cut off food assistance for states that don't provide information to support his immigration crackdown. Heading into a primary season which factions will battle over the future of the party, Democratic governors largely sang from the same sheet over the weekend. A dozen candidates and sitting governors all said they plan to talk extensively about the cost of housing, child care, utilities, and groceries during this second term of Trump. But the unified focus on affordability papers over real divisions in the party's ranks over how to aggressively confront Trump, who won all of the presidential battleground states last year, and now on how to deal with rising costs that's squeezing most Americans. On the same day, Democratic moderates with national security credentials, Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey and Abigail Spanberger in Virginia, won their governor's races. And in the Democratic Socialist, Zohran Mamdani won election as New York mayor. And all of them ran on promises to tackle affordability. But they offered very different visions to how to deliver. This strategy isn't without risk. Economic conditions could change, making concerns about prices less salient or urgent. And the Democrats could be setting themselves up for disappointment down the road if they win in 2026, but are unable to bring down costs to voter satisfaction, allowing Republicans to capitalize on the same buyer's remorse Democrats are seeking to stoke. For Democratic incumbents seeking re-election, they can't rest on fighting the Trump administration, said two-term Democratic Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham of New Mexico. They need to show results. Deliver for me, but don't forget to fight this, said Lujan Grisham, who is barred by term limits from seeking re-election. They do want both, and finding ways to cross-cut those and marry that, I think, would be a winning set of messages. But, of course, after the New Jersey-Virginia elections, the White House has started to shift its message to focus more on this issue of affordability. And Trump, who has not done much domestic travel during his second term, is scheduled to visit Pennsylvania on Tuesday to highlight his efforts to reduce inflation. He's talked more about affordability recently and reduced tariffs on beef and other commodities that consumers say cost too much. But he's also said that the economy is better and consumer prices lower than reported by the media. The word affordability is a Democratic scam, he said during a cabinet meeting last week. He continues to blame his Democratic predecessor, former President Joe Biden, for the increase nationwide in inflation rates that occurred this year after his return to the White House. Now, as far as I know, Joe Biden isn't in the White House. Overall, inflation is tracking at 3% annually, up from 2.3% in April when Trump rolled out a sweeping set of import taxes. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent on Sunday said the administration will be intent on reducing inflation after tackling immigration and pushing to have interest rates cut. So there you go.
All right, more on the political scene. I've got a commentary by William Colby, a modern Joan of Arc or outrage entrepreneur. U.S. Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, has undoubtedly become one of the most polarizing figures in American politics, frequently drawing national attention for her inflammatory rhetoric, conspiracy theories, and provocative social media posts. Early into Greene's career as a congresswoman, the House voted to remove her committee assignments for her violent endorsements and incendiary comments. Greene was once one of President Donald Trump's loudest fans, proudly touting her Make America Great Again credentials ever since she joined Congress in 2021. But in recent months, her political views appear to have evolved, and she has broken with the Trump administration on a number of issues from foreign policy to health care, showing no hesitation in calling out the president on social media. She was best known as a conservative firebrand and conspiracy loon. Now, amidst her pivots of political posture and rhetoric in an apparent political renaissance, could she be acting more like a modern-day Joan of Arc, rallying people in a crusade against the destructive forces of imperiling America? Or, true to her penchant as an outrage entrepreneur, is there something bigger at play? Are we watching a middle-aged career woman take the market for her political and professional ambitions, choreographing a series of political stunts to promote a campaign in the making? Greene is acting in completely rational and predictable manner, wrote Kate Plummer in Newsweek. Spouting tinfoil hat conspiracy theories won't help her, and to her credit, she realizes that. Of course, this born-again political moderation won't harm her if she runs for higher office either. Stay tuned. Regardless of Greene's motives and machinations, something is going on with her that's making more sense, even to her detractors. The conservative Trump devotee from whom America has come to expect off-the-cuff and often crude commentary has been undeniably good-natured, coming across as astonishingly reasonable during a number of public appearances and pronouncements. Greene has blamed Republican leaders for government shutdowns, sided with Democrats in calling for an extension of tax credits for health insurance, rallied against high inflation and stated that her party has, quote, no plan. She has called Trump for Trump to prioritize America rather than become entangled in foreign conflicts. Amid the Israeli-Hamas war, Green was the first Republican to call Israel's actions in Gaza genocide, which Israel has denied, and urged her colleagues to support an end to supply weapons to Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's armed forces. When the federal government was in its shutdown during clashes between Democrats and Republicans on health care subsidies, Green called out Republicans for not addressing rising health care costs. Green was one of four Republicans to join Democrats in signing a discharge petition to force a vote on releasing all government files on Jeffrey Epstein. She had been contacted by White House officials who tried to pressure her to withdraw from the petition, but she stood firm. Economic pain, institutional mistrust, and political exhaustion are converging into something volatile, a storm of disillusionment that no amount of populist rhetoric can overcome, said Matt Wiley in the State, a daily newspaper based in Columbia, South Carolina. The GOP needs to start governing more effectively, or the cracks in the MAGA movement will only widen. That realization may also now be dawning on other Republicans after the recent electoral mini-rout, but Green not only saw it happening sooner, she began planning for her future around it. She may be planning for a day when the MAGA movement is not led by Trump or even by a member of his administration, but by a leader who can speak on behalf of its disgruntled base. Excuse me, somebody like her. I think America needs to come together and end all the toxic, dangerous rhetoric and divide. And I'm leading the way with my own example, and I hope that President Trump can do the same, Green told CNN's Dana Bash. Taken at face value, it sounds like a mea culpa, a decision to turn away from the extreme, noxious style that has characterized her political career, just as it's ending. The growing divide between Trump and Green finally came to a head when the president revoked his endorsement of Green in a scathing social media post in which he labeled her wacky and a ranting lunatic. In a shocking move on November 21st, she responded by announcing her resignation from Congress. Her last day will be January 5th, 2026. The reality is that they, common Americans, the people, possess the real power over Washington. And then I'll be here by their side to rebuild it, Green said in her farewell address. Until then, I'm going back to the people I love, to live life to the fullest as I always have, and look forward to a new path ahead. Could Green be on the verge of causing fissures in the cult of Trump? Her desire to talk openly about what Mr. Trump's party should stand for beyond unyielding allegiance to him increasingly appears to be shared by some conservative officials and aspiring leaders. What we are witnessing is that Trump appears to yield absolute mastery over the GOP. That is, until there are circumstances or events that dramatically challenge or alter his ability to sustain that illusion. And when the illusion has been shattered, reality quickly follows suit. Marjorie Taylor Greene should be setting herself up to take the reins of that new reality. I believe people are capable of change, and in Greene's case, even be de-radicalized from the far right and its quagmire of conspiracy theories and extremism. But even if she's changing for the better, it won't alter the fact that she has caused so much harm during her time in the public eye. That might be difficult for her to reconcile and the American people to absolve going forward. Dr. William Kobe, an Andover resident, is a retired high school and college teacher and former Peace Corps volunteer in Tonga and El Salvador.
Interesting article.
Yes, very much so.
Okay, so I'm going to step aside from politics. I'm going to try very hard here. and this is in the lifestyle section of the Lowell Sun. And it says, some top spots for visiting with Santa around the Bay State this season. The rest of the world may be a wee bit jealous because based on his upcoming appearances, Santa absolutely loves the Bay State. From cozy Back Bay parlors to Cape Cod seashore backdrops, the big guy and the missus most times, will hop across Massachusetts until he returns to the North Pole for his big night. And I have, she says, I have these day trip visits to consider. First of all, he's going to be in the city of Boston. Santa in the City takes place December 13th and December 20th from noon to 6 p.m. in the brownstone directly across from Sweet Green in Hines Place. I'm not sure where that is. Stop by and be welcomed into the brownstone with classic Back Bay decor, holiday decorations, and Santa himself. Santa is happy to review wish lists, discuss gift choices, pose for photos, and he'll have his own personal photographer there as well to capture your visit. And there's bonus fun, too. Right across the street at the Pru, or it's near the Prudential Center, you'll find Treehouse Brewing's Winter Garden, as well as an immersive winter light show. Santa shares his posh holiday escape, too. And you can't blame Santa for needing some posh TLC pregame, so it's no surprise he finds time to stay a night or two at the Dagny Boston. And their holiday gilded suite is available to him and to you all holiday season. The limited time decor immerses you in holiday ambiance with twinkling garlands and more. And you'll be greeted by Santa's favorite scent, fresh baked cookies from the Tradesman's Coffee Shop. And the lights of Boston will be outside, too, for people.
I would have thought it would be pine trees.
Yeah, no. Fresh baked cookies. So, she says, all right, no time to stay over in the city. No worries. Santa will appear in the hotel, which is called the Dagny Hotel. I don't know of that. Will appear in the, its decorated lobby December 18th to 22nd. Where you can take photos or grab the hotel's classic Polaroid to capture one. Times vary each day and can be found on the website, which is the dagnyboston.com. Santa also likes grown-up holiday fun, too, which is why he applauds Cambridge's Kimpton Marlowe Hotel. In its eighth season, the pop-up bar surrounds you in holiday cheer, with lighted garlands, a crackling fire, and festive decor. And then, of course, there are the adult holiday cocktails, with names like Dancing Sugar Plums, Candy Cane Lane, Cherry Chocosaurus.
That's an interesting one.
Blitz and Barrel, Miracle Mouse, and, this sounds good, Coconut Hot Chocolate.
Ooh.
Their nice and naughty shots are back, too. Santa knows we don't all imbibe those, so they're introducing new non-alcoholic options like Snow Day Sipper, Silent Night, and Mellow Mouse. You'll sip on these season-themed cocktails in a cool glassware shaped like Santa's head? Shaped like Santa's head.
Interesting.
And a Santa saur. Oh, so that must be some
like
a dinosaur.
Yeah.
And a holiday unicorn. I might have to go and see this.
Yeah, just to see the paraphernalia.
You can purchase, of course, the limited edition glassware for holiday gifts. And lastly, she brings up, how about Santa at the beach? And as any Bay State lover knows, Santa understands a good escape to the Cape is always in order. So she suggests that at the Pelham House, which is, website is www.pelhamhouseresort.com. And this resort is on the beach in Dennisport. And on December 21st, he'll be up close and personal at his annual brunch. Brunch takes place at the resort's rooftop restaurant. And while you'll feel like you're outside thanks to the floor-to-ceiling windows, you'll be snug since it's enclosed and heated in the winter. And, of course, on that night, Santa will be on hand to mingle with the guests, take requests, pose for photos, and just plain celebrate with you for Christmas.
Nice.
There you go.
All right, I'm going to move on to today in history and get off the politics, though there is some political stuff in today's history, but it's definitely not Trumpisms. Okay, December 8th, U.S. enters World War II. The Associated Press. Today is Monday, December 8th, the 342nd day of 2025. There are 23 days left in the year. Today in history, on December 8th, 1941, the United States entered World War II as Congress declared war against Imperial Japan a day after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Also on this date, in 1980, rock star and former Beatle John Lennon was shot to death outside his New York apartment building by Mark David Chapman. In 1987, President Ronald Reagan and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev signed a treaty at the White House calling for the destruction of immediate-range missiles. In 2012, Texas A&M quarterback Johnny Manziel became the first freshman to win the Heisman Trophy. In 2014, the U.S. and NATO ceremonial ended their combat mission in Afghanistan 13 years after the September 11th attack, sparked their invasion of the country to topple the Taliban-led government. In 2016, John Glenn, whose 1962 flight as the first U.S. astronaut to orbit the Earth made him an American hero and propelled him to a long career in the United States Senate, died in Columbus, Ohio at the age of 95. In 2017, Japanese pitching and hitting star Shohei Ohtani, I don't know if I said that right, announced that he would sign with the Los Angeles Angels. In 2022, Russia freed WNBA star Brittany Griner in a high-profile prison exchange with the U.S. that released Russian arms dealer Viktor Bout. Griner had been detained for nearly 10 months. And lastly, in 2024, insurgents completed their occupation of the Syrian capital of Damascus as a half-century of Assad family rule swiftly crumbled. Russian state media reported that President Bashar Assad was in Moscow after fleeing the rebel advance. Okay, we have time for literally something super quick.
It's a quite a short one. In the advice column here, which this is an old story, I think, but it's well worth listening. Dear Annie, my 11-year-old son Max used to eat, sleep, and breathe baseball. He wore his glove to the grocery store, slept in his favorite team shirt, spent hours in the backyard throwing balls. And this year he finally made the local travel team. And it was a dream come true. Instead, it's turned into a slow-motion heartbreak.
Aww.
The coach, his name is Brian, is one of those, you know the type, old-school, win-it-all types. He yells when the kids strike out, rolls his eyes when someone misses a grounder, and has actually said things like, maybe baseball isn't your sport, loudly enough for everyone to hear. He rarely plays my son, and when Max does get in the game, the coach seems to be waiting for him to fail. My once confident, baseball-obsessed boy asks, do we have to go to practice? He says he's bad at baseball, talks about quitting. And when I raised my concerns to the coach, he brushed it off and said, the boys need to toughen up if they want to compete. And I don't want to be that overprotective parent who runs to the rescue every time life gets hard, but I don't want one more season with this harsh coach to crush my son's love of the game. What should I do? And there's a brief section here to answer. You're not overreacting. There's a big difference between a coach who pushes kids to work hard and one who chips away at their confidence. Talk to Max, away from the field and ask what he wants to do. Does he still love baseball or hate this team? Does he want it to finish the season? Let him know that you'll support whatever decision he makes. And then if you have the energy, try one more brief, calm conversation with the coach. My son is coming home discouraged, saying he's bad at baseball. I'm concerned about how feedback is being delivered. Their response will tell you a lot. If nothing changes and Max is miserable, you're allowed to pull him and to look for another team with a different coach who actually understands how to work with kids. One harsh season should not cost a child his love for the game. After all, at 11 years old, the goal is not to toughen up at all costs. The goal is teamwork, resilience, and joy. You're not rescuing him from life. You're rescuing him from an unnecessary bully in a ball cap.
And I like that
perfectly
article.
Agree with that.
Yes, I wholeheartedly
agree. I see it all the time with my grandson's football teams.
There are some people that never got to live out their dreams as kids, and then they take it out at the on the kids that they're coaching. It's
grab
stupid.
Them by face mask.
Oh, that's horrible.
It is.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to say thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio reading services, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Visit our website where you can tune into LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Diane and Paul, and we thank you for listening. Paul, would you like to say something?
Yes. Have a good week. It's cold. Wrap up.
Yeah, huh? And if you can get out to some of those holiday festivities,
yes.
By all means, participate, particularly if you have children. That would be awesome. Have a safe and comfortable week, everyone, and we will be back tomorrow. Thank you. Bye-bye.